Testing. Ah, perfect. Okay. So last week we realized that there are physical challenges in meditation. And we found that through yoga and stretching, perhaps, we can deal with some of those challenges in a skillful way and not let them hinder our progress or our practice. Now, in early Buddhism, there is something called the five hindrances to meditation. These are psychological hindrances. These are roadblocks. And I'm going to talk about that today and some of the cures for these roadblocks, some of the things you can do. So, I cut and paste some of it. And so this is what I came up with. There are five impediments and hindrances. Overgrowths of the mind that stultify insight. What five? Sensual desire is an impediment and hindrance. An overgrowth of the mind that stultifies insight. Ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, or restlessness and remorse, skeptical doubt. So the five are sensual desire, anger and hatred, agitation and worry, sloth and torpor, and skeptical doubt. Now, in the early Buddhist tradition, there are four levels of nirvana. The first level of nirvana is called stream enterer. The second level of nirvana is called once returner. The third level of nirvana is called non-returner. And the fourth level is called arhat, one who is fully perfected, one who has achieved nirvana. So how do these five hindrances fit into the four levels of being an arhat, or four levels of nirvana? Skeptical doubt is eliminated as at stream entry. So the first of the five hindrances to go is skeptical doubt, and that's when you become a stream enterer. Then sensual desire, ill will, and remorse are eliminated on the third stage, the path of the non-returner. Sloth and torpor and restlessness are eradicated on the path of the arhat, or arhat. So I like this sort of idea, because as we wrestle with these five hindrances in our meditation practice, we really need to keep in mind that suppressing them isn't the deal. We have to work skillfully with them, and as our practice deepens and we get closer to our nirvana, they will fall away. There's also a model of the five hindrances and the five aspects of the first jhana. First jhana has applied thought, sustained thought, happiness, bliss, and equanimity. And those counterbalance, or those balance, or those nullify the five hindrances. So that's an interesting model as well. Let's start with sense desire, sensual desire. Now, our senses simply want to be fed pleasant things. The eye wants to look at pretty things. The ear wants to hear pleasant sounds. The nose wants to smell flowers. The tongue wants to taste chocolate cake. The body wants to feel cashmere. You know, our sense doors just simply want to be fed all this really good stuff. And it seems the more we try to satisfy our sensual desires, the more desire and craving we have. So it sort of works against us. And ultimately, we can't satisfy those sensual desires. There's no way to ultimately satisfy your smell. I mean, if you smell the best thing you've ever smelled, you know, you can't tell yourself, gosh, I'll never have to smell again, because I've just smelled the best thing I've ever smelled. Or I've just tasted the best meal I've ever had. I'll never have to taste again. And sure enough, in a couple hours, you're ready to taste something new or something else, satisfy that hunger. So for me, working with the sense desires was really difficult, because it required me to approach it as an ascetic, as a mendicant. And what you were saying, what I was saying to myself was, okay, I realize that I will be attracted to pleasant sounds and pleasant sights and pleasant smells and pleasant tastes and pleasant touch. But for the 20 minutes I'm meditating, I'm going to let those sense desires rest. I'm not going to take heed when they arise. Now, rebound. See, you can put them to rest for a little while, but they come back and they get you. There used to be a store in Westwood Village called Rhino Records. And Rhino Records used to have the best used CD collection. You know, $2-3. Some of them promo copies, some were just used copies. So I'd be meditating and I'd be renouncing the whole world, and I'd always end up at Rhino Records buying CDs. In my CD collection getting bigger and bigger and bigger, I'm thinking, my gosh, I'm rebounding from getting rid of my desires. They're just waiting to arise in another way at another time. So we really have to be cautious when we start playing with our desires and start saying, you know, I'm not going to satisfy you, because they will be satisfied one way or the other. They will trick us. So thankfully, Rhino Records is closed, but now you can download MP3s. It's even easier now. So if you've been meditating for 20 minutes, you get up and go to Amazon.com and go to the little download service, you know. Be cautious. You might find yourself consuming more as you try to get rid of everything, all those desires. So, but now they go on and they talk about how to alleviate some of those sensual desires, what you need to do, some of the strategies that you can use. Yes? Yes, they can be transformed until they're finally eradicated. You know, because they will get eradicated, but you're going to have to wait to the third level, you know, of enlightenment or nirvana. So until then, we need to work with them. And this is what the early Buddhist text talks about. Learning how to meditate on impure objects as a way of balancing your sensual desire. Now, what does that mean? And why would that be useful? It would allow you to bring everything back into balance. You see, you have this really strong desire that needs to be satisfied. And now, for instance, say you're really, really hungry. You just can hardly, everything looks really good. You know, you can, anything, any kind of food. So maybe you could meditate on the foulness of food. And you know, have you ever, you know, seen a tomato when it's rotten? Have you ever smelled, you know, decaying meat that's been in the refrigerator too long and stuff? The idea is not to be repulsed by that. The idea is to bring your desire back into balance, using the negative to counteract the positive. This is a tough one, though. We have to be really skillful because we don't want to become anorexic. You know, I mean, it can go that way, too. You can just really get into it and really see the repulsiveness of food all the time. So they need to meditate on how pleasant food is, how wonderful food is, to bring their issue back into balance. Again, sense desire, one of the meditation objects is meditating on corpses. You know, when you're really attracted to physical beauty, you know, and what was I looking at? Steve Reeves. Anybody remember Steve Reeves? Now, Steve Reeves was not George Reeves' brother. George Reeves was the television Superman back in the 50s. Steve Reeves was Hercules. Had this sort of beard thing, and he was just, he was like Mr. Olympus, Mr. America back in the 50s. And when I was young, when I was like 12 or 13, I wanted to look like that. That was my ideal of what a man should look like. You know, I mean, he was just like this V figure, you know, and every woman really liked him, I'm assuming. And as it turns out, that's probably not the case. But when you're 13, that's what you think. That's how, you know. And I'm thinking, wow, yeah, yeah. And so for a while, I had like a little weight set, and I would do my little weights and stuff, but nothing ever came of it. You know, and I'm thinking, yeah, sometimes we can just get so fixated on how beautiful the body can be, or how desirable that body is or seems to be, and that's what we want. And all I would have needed to do would be to look at corpses for a while and realize Steve Reeves was also going to be one of those corpses eventually. Or, anybody seen the show Pumping Iron, the movie Pumping Iron, Arnold Schwarzenegger? That guy was amazing. And again, this was in my, when I was in my 20s, I was working out, and he was my ideal. I wanted to be like Arnold. Well, that, finally the movie came out on DVD, and then they were interviewing all the guys that were in the movie back then, and you looked at them now, and they were all old men. I'm thinking, where did all that go? They're just old men. So I see how illusory this all is, how it's smoke and mirrors, and yet our desires are based on those smoke and mirrors. You know, if only I get the latest iPod, my life will be really good, and it'll sound better than my old iPod. And I mean, who can tell the difference? But we just sort of get caught in that, and this is to break that. This is to sort of stop us for a moment so we can reflect and view it from a different perspective. Hopefully a perspective of peace. Devoting oneself to the meditation on the impure, guarding the sense doors. Now, in Thailand, what they do is they, when the monks go on their begging rounds for food, they never have direct eye contact with the people who are giving them the food. They never do that because it creates all sorts of stuff, all sorts of scenarios and stories in their head. Now, one guy, and he was an American monk who was over being trained in Thailand, was going on alms rounds. And he's an older guy. He's 40s and 50s and stuff. And so he was very peaceful, and he was no eye contact at all. And he went to this one house with the rest of the monks. And the young girl, the teenage girl, was giving the food. And innocently, her hand touched his hand. And it was like a spark, he said. And he lost balance. And he realized that, you know, he hadn't been touched by a woman for years. And he had to, like, leave the group and go back to the monastery. It's just the whole thing. So our sense doors need to be guarded if we're in, say, on retreat, where they often discourage speaking and looking at each other and idle chatter and gossip. It's like we need to be focused. We need to be aware that if we give our sense doors full rein, they will take over. So sometimes I've been invited to go to Catholic high schools to speak, all girls schools, you know, and I'm just watching the tiles on the floor when I walk through the hallways. It's just, you know, no way. And yet the teachers and everybody else there seems to, there's no big deal. I guess they're used to it. So I really have to be aware of what my environment is and guard myself from my mind, which will wake up and create all sorts of desire and confusion. Now, I don't know if that makes sense, but maybe for you, as females, if you're in a boys' locker room, you just look at the tiles, you know, and go through there, you know. And it's funny because most people don't think that matters very much, but the mind is volatile. Our consciousness is always seeking outside things. And as soon as I became aware of that, I became a lot more cautious in who I looked at, how long I looked at them, what kind of conversations I had with people, things of that sort. Moderation in eating is another way to deal with sense desire. There was this Japanese monk I was talking to, and I said, "What's your secret on being celibate, sensei?" And he said, "I don't eat very much." And there you go. That was his practice. He didn't eat very much. And those desires didn't arise. And I had a friend, a German girl, German woman friend, who had just found a new boyfriend. And he didn't seem very engaged. He didn't seem very lustful. So her mind was, okay, I've got to feed him steak every night when he comes over. I got to, you know, he lacks protein. And I'm going, okay, so if we look at food as really changing our consciousness, and I don't know if you've ever been really hungry and had food, and all of a sudden you sort of feel high because all those calories are sort of rushing in there. It's amazing. I find with myself, if I haven't eaten for a while, and I start to eat, I can see better. I feel like I'm like the predator now, and this is my meat, you know, and food, and I'm just sort of like, it's an odd thing. So as I wrestle now with my food intake and been ramping it down to maybe a meal a day or a meal and a half a day, I find that it does alter my consciousness, and depending on what I eat. Do you find that too?
Well, in Ayurveda, you have the sattvic, the rajasic, and the tamasic, and there are foods like bagels and cream cheese for me. They put me in a coma, and I mean, I've known this for a long time. It's just those carbs, for some reason, that it's dead food, where if I eat vegetables, fresh, green stuff, that's sattvic.
It adds to your energy.
And then they have like, don't eat garlic, because that, if you're already a little rajasic or energetic, then that will like get you all wound up. And in our culture, Cubans, they eat a lot of garlic. So it's like, how can I stay away from garlic? I love garlic. But I do notice the change, just, it's very subtle. But yeah. I don't know about giving up the protein, though, I think, or the animal protein, I should say. I always struggle with
Well, that. Sensei was a vegetarian. Besides not eating much, he was a vegetarian, and that seems to work. Well, in his line of work, it was fine, because he would meditate all day.
Are most Buddhists vegetarians, or is it just certain groups of
Buddhists? Certain groups are. Oh. Certain groups are. So early Buddhists, no, they're the meat eaters. Mahayana, China, Japan, Vietnam, Korea, vegetarian. Tibetan meat eaters. So it was more practical than anything else. There's not such a moral thing happening, with that. But it does affect the way you perceive the world, I'm finding, depending on what I'm eating that day, yesterday I had fish. It was a good day. I was
And the way that it's processed too, and even like, I don't know, I saw this one guy in Hawaii catch this fish, right? And he was this old dude, and he was running down the cliff, and I mean, it was amazing. And I followed him down, and he said, he was going to go home and feed his family this fish.
Yeah.
And that seemed like a beautiful thing. But when you go into the supermarket and you have all this fish, and it's all pre-cut and packaged and.
In plastic, and they change the dates, the expiration dates.
Yeah.
A lot of the food that we find in supermarkets, I've been told, is like grown like corn and wheat. It's not fresh and natural. And so as I'm getting older, and as I see the importance of eating better, because when you're young, you can eat anything, and it seems to work. Food is important, but moderation in food, I'm finding, is really important. It also allows you to meditate better, if you don't have a big meal before you sit down, and then you'll fall asleep, because it's so, wow. And the monks, fall asleep after lunch, because, Theravada tradition, breakfast after sunrise, and then lunch before 12, and then from like 1 to 3, they're napping, because they have all this food now. And then they're up the rest of the day and the evening, until the sunrise for more food. So we have to be cautious if we're going to do retreat. That's why they don't feed us a lot or feed us vegetarian, because we need to have a sort of a balance. Noble friendship. Hanging around with the right people will lessen your desires, And sometimes they pick us, sometimes we pick them. But it's amazing. What our friends or people, our acquaintances, can get us to think about and get us to do. The peer pressure and stuff, When generally speaking, we wouldn't, be attracted to that at all. So at the center, I spend a lot of time in my room, because we have 30 people that aren't monastics who live at our meditation center. And they're always talking about all sorts of stuff. And that's fine, but it doesn't really, not important for me. I've got a website to put together and talks to give and stuff. So I realize that I've got to be really careful with who I hang around with so I don't get caught up in stuff, Well, let's go out to a movie, let's go out to food, let's go to a bar, you don't have to drink, I will, all that kind of stuff. And I'm going, man, I don't think so. I don't want to have fun.
They could go there for a short
It depends. We've had some people are living there. They've lived there 15, 20 years. We have two people that just moved in who are going to be there for about 2 weeks. They came from Indiana, and they'll be moving out to someplace else. You know?
They are to learn about Buddhism, but they're not
monks? No, they're not even into Buddhism. Well, I shouldn't say. One is, one isn't. Most of the people that live at our center aren't Buddhist, don't practice Buddhism, and don't meditate. But we don't charge much to live there. It's easy to get in, and it's easy to get out. And not to be cynical, but it's more than just the cheap, you know, money. I think a lot of people like living in community. I think, you know, everybody, there's 8 million of us trying to live together, and we don't know them. They're all strangers to us. So here you're living in a house, an old two-story craftsman house with five people you didn't pick to live next to you. You see them in the, you know, waiting for the bathroom. You see them using your, or using the kitchen utensils. There's community kitchen utensils and the stove and the refrigerator. And you interact with people all day long when you're at the center. And I think it's healthy. I think it's psychologically much healthier than living alone. But there, you know, conversations can go in many different ways. And so I'm always cautious about getting caught up in a conversation or hanging around the people that might perceive things differently than I do. So, but, you know, that's what my mom told me to do, too, you know. Pick my friends well. And I'm just, so it's actually mom was right. Okay, ill will, anger and hatred. This is so tough to get rid of, anger and hatred. You know, and one of the best antidotes for anger and hatred is patience. Simply patience. Because your anger and hatred will go away. So, what did they say? They call it denourishing. I like that. Denourishing ill will. Cultivate the meditation on loving kindness. For by cultivating the meditation on loving kindness, ill will disappears. And I still haven't posted that loving kindness meditation on your page yet, but I will. If you can, you should put that as part of your daily ritual, daily routine. Before you sit and meditate, say the loving kindness, meditate for 20 minutes, and then afterwards say the loving kindness. Before you go to sleep at night, if you're going to meditate first, say it before you meditate, meditate, say it afterwards. It really does allow you to get rid of a lot of those little pieces of anger and hatred that sort of cling to us, little fragments almost, you know? And that's the one thing I think most people have to deal with, you know, the hardest thing for most people to deal with is their dislike of a situation or a person, you know?
One question.
Pardon?
I have a question.
Yes, please. Yes, Rhino Records.
Yeah, you'd end up at Rhino
Rebound.
Records, and you ended up like buying more, like it kind of.
Yeah, to compensate for pretending
so
to buy less.
Do you think that that can happen with anger too?
It surely can.
My sister for the past 24 hours, I'm like obsessing over it, and you know, like it kind of, you're focusing on not being angry, and then it sort of like happens where you're just really angry.
Yeah, you know, you have to be really careful. That's why patience is a good way to do it, because if we try to suppress it or say, I'm going to forgive her, and then you see her and you just, like, you know, blast her and you go, where did that come from? And I've done that. I've thought it was completely gone. And then I saw the person and I went nuts. And I'm thinking, whoa. You know, I hadn't resolved the issue for myself and between us. So one of the ways to do that is to practice patience with her, and perhaps patience with yourself as well. Now, the patience will ultimately turn into an acceptance, and that acceptance will ultimately turn into forgiveness. Now, I have an issue with acceptance and forgiveness. And I was talking to Father Gill about this issue. I said, Father Gill, Buddhists are better than Catholics. You know why? Yes. And he said, why, Kusla? And I said, because we don't have forgiveness in Buddhism, we have acceptance. Well, he said, what's the difference? Well, I said, well, when you forgive somebody, you're up here and they're down here, and you've got the power of them. But when you accept someone, you're equal. And Buddhism is always about being equal. So I think it's better than Father Gill. And Father Gill was such a nice man. He's passed away since. But he's such a nice man, and he really was so kind with me, being overly aggressive and being really stupid. And he said, well, think about it this way, Kusala. What do acceptance and forgiveness do? I said, I don't know. He said, they bring the relationship back into balance. And the whole idea with acceptance and forgiveness is to bring the relationship back into balance. So, it's tough. But once it's back into balance, you can look at her and not feel that. And she won't feel that either. And even if you forgive her first, or you accept her first, the way you respond to her will be noticeable by her. She'll recognize something's different, you know. And it's really, I don't know, from a Buddhist perspective, you wouldn't be doing it because it's the right thing. You'd really be doing it because being in balance and resolving those issues creates less suffering for both of you. Now, my mom, I used anger to her advantage. And what she did when my stepdad was still alive, she would go pick a fight with him. He'd be sitting, he's in his retired, he's like 80s, 90s, and he'd be sitting watching TV, and she'd go up and start arguing with him about some insignificant little thing. And he just played along with it. He was a really a nice guy. And then she'd go vacuum and do the laundry. And I picked up on why she started to argue, because she needed the extra energy to go vacuum and do the laundry. So, you know, so it worked out fine for both of them, because he had a clean house and, you know. So there are times when maybe we can use some of that energy to our advantage, you know, but we have to be so careful because it can burn us so easily. Okay, how would I look at that?
Yeah.
Well, as a Buddhist, we don't have justice, you see. So when I look at the injustice in the world, and there is much injustice in the world, we would say karma will take care of it. We don't have to get involved. Now, we do get involved, but not because of justice. We get involved because of suffering. If we can help the people suffer less on both sides, then we're using the Buddhist perspective. Please, continue.
So does that mean all the people who are hungry did something wrong in their past lives, so that's why they're suffering now?
Oh, that is... No, it's too easy. You can't go there. And we can't say they've sinned, and that's why 9 million people are now starving to death in Africa or something, because they've sinned. No, as a Buddhist, we can't go there. It's just too easy, and there's never one thing. It's never one thing why stuff happens. I don't know if I've talked about this, but I'll talk about it again. There are 5 reasons in Buddhism why stuff happens. They're called the niyamas. This is early Buddhism, Theravada tradition. The first reason that stuff happens is because of natural laws, for instance, like gravity. So if we slip and fall, we can't blame the banana peel only. We have to say, well, if I didn't have gravity, I would have just slipped but not fallen. So there are natural things that occur, tsunamis, earthquakes. Those things will make our life miserable, but not because we've sinned, but because of the earth's plates are shifting. Okay, number one. The second reason stuff happens in Buddhism is genes and chromosomes. Now, we were talking earlier about getting a genetic test. We are predisposed to go in certain directions when we're born because of our genes and chromosomes. So I was made to be tall. Actually, I was made to be tall and thin, so it really didn't work. Now I'm just tall. And so we could say, for instance, there was this terrible shooting at a campus a year or so. Actually, there's been a few of them. And you might say, well, how could genetics have played a part in the shooting on campus to the victims who were shot? I mean, why would that be the case? Well, perhaps it's because the parents were born in that community and they stayed there and they gave birth to the children who went to school there. So their genetics had something to do with them going to that school because that's where they lived. Okay, so one way of looking at it. Third, karma, cause and consequence. This is the moral aspect of why stuff happens. If we are unskillful, not evil, but if we are unskillful, then we will have uncomfortable consequences. And if we are skillful, we'll have less uncomfortable consequences. Fourth reason stuff happens, according to Buddhism, is religious practice, dharma. Your religious practice affects what you do and what happens to you. It's fascinating. So I had never thought about that until I became religious, that that's why people have a religious practice, because they want to change their life and perhaps change the world as well. Fifth, last but not least, mind, consciousness, the way we look at stuff, our habit patterns, if we're prejudiced, if we think that, women shouldn't get the vote, only men should, that will affect the way the world works. So, if something happens to me, I can't say karma, I can't say sin, I can't blame God. I have to look at these five things and see how they're combined to create this consequence for me. What does that do? That makes me less of a victim. I think if you can point at one thing and say, you're the reason why my life sucks, you can be a really big victim. But if you say, gosh, it's this combination of things, there's no one thing ever that makes this happen. Now, having said all this, I must say, when we had that tsunami that went into Thailand, a Buddhist scholar, well known, said it was their karma. I know. And I wrote a little paper about it. And so you can find out who it was if you go to my website. I heard a Christian say it was sin. And it was God, taking care of the sinners. And the Muslim said this, and everybody, they're all pointing at one thing. They're trying to simplify it and give meaning to this terrible event. And that's when it gets to be problematic, I think. When you start pointing your finger at one thing and saying, see? So, thank you for the question, because it gave me a chance to expand on this very important aspect in Buddhism. So we don't get involved because there's injustice in the world. We get involved because there's suffering in the world. So it's not just that 9 million people are starving, but what can a Buddhist do to make them starve less? Can we feed them? Not because it's the right thing to do, but because it relieves their suffering. Much different way of looking at the world. And you might say, well, it's similar to Christianity. And I would say, no, absolutely not. We have such a unique way of looking at the world. We don't, because when you have a God that defines for you what is right and wrong, what is just and unjust, then you have this sort of moral obligation. And you feel good about it because you're doing the right thing. Well, Buddhists never feel that doing the right thing. Sometimes they feel it's the only thing they can do, But it's not necessary. It's never the right thing to do.
Yes. I know that with Christianity, it almost ends up being more about you and you feeling good than about the person you're trying to help.
And you're talking, and we're talking earlier about Oprah giving her money away. It's almost about And so, how would you bypass that? Do you think? How would you practice not feeling good at giving stuff away? Say you have a few extra dollars and you want to give it away. How would you give it away and not feel good about it?
Be anonymous.
Be anonymous. It's hard to be anonymous, though.
Why can't you feel good about it?
Huh?
What's wrong with feeling good about it?
Well, nothing. That's a good place to start. But you get much more merit, according to Buddhism, if you have equanimity about the gift. If you don't,
Exactly.
And then there are no strings attached to it. You can give your money to a homeless guy and you don't care what he does with it.
I'm saying, what if it just makes you really happy just to give? Like when people come over, I love to cook for them and give them tea. Like that just makes me so happy.
Yeah.
They never give me tea or cooked fat.
And that makes you so angry.
Do that with equanimity, without feeling.
Well, we would look at that as being hospitality. And that's a very important aspect of all religions. You know, so from a religious standpoint, that would be perfectly, you know, I mean, that would be the thing you're supposed to do. That's your duty, to be hospitable. But you happen to enjoy your duty. And I'm sure they enjoy it too. You just wish they would reciprocate. Okay. So let me tell you how to practice giving anonymously. Vending machines. Put your money in the vending machine, leave the money behind in the little slot. Works every time. Huh? Can you watch and see who picks it up? Well, you know what's weird about that is they'll be so excited. It won't have anything to do with the amount of money. It'll be their day. They found money. So it's a wonderful way to give. And it doesn't hurt our pocketbook at all.
Sometimes I would feel like guilty. Like, I wonder if this was jammed for the person and now I'm getting the benefit of what they tried to get earlier. I would almost feel guilty taking them from the vending machine.
Well, I think you're an exception. I think most people would think it's their lucky day. You know, if you got two candy bars instead of one, you know. And it's just, sometimes, you know, maybe it was their karma not to get that extra candy bar. And it's your karma to get it. So you can feel guilty and leave it behind for the next person. Then they'll get three candy bars.
I'm excited if I pull into a parking spot and there's...
And there's a parking spot, yeah.
Yeah, we'll
yeah. I'm excited if I'm not parked to an SUV. Because I can't ever get out of my car. I've got a little car, you know, and this thing is like the Wall of China. And I'm going, oh, man. But that's life. You probably all have SUVs, and I'm sorry. But it's just, so we can't blame anything. It was just one thing. We can practice generosity using vending machines. Cool. We can start small. We don't have to start big. And it's amazing how we can change people's lives with those random acts of kindness. People aren't used to being, you know, aren't used to the kindness anymore. You know, everybody's so angry all the time. Loving kindness meditation. Cultivate meditation on compassion. Cultivate meditation on sympathetic joy. Cultivate meditation on equanimity. Those are the four immeasurables. Those are also called the Brahma Viharas. And this is the training of being a bodhisattva. When you start to practice those four measurables.
Sympathetic joy.
It's the hardest one of all. It is so hard. Sympathetic joy is when somebody wins the lottery and you're happy they won and not you. Sympathetic joy is when you're more happy when your husband or wife succeeds than you are. Or you do. You know, it's that kind of thing. Now, it may be easier with somebody that you love to have sympathetic joy, but these are with strangers. And I can't even watch the big spin. Because, you know, I just... Those are people that do the lottery thing. I can't watch it. Because I'm thinking, you know, gosh, I could get a temple with that money. And I could, you know. And they're just going to spend it foolishly and have a terrible life. And, you know. So sympathetic joy for me is the most difficult. I've broken it down this way. The first one, loving kindness... That's the intention. That's the intention we want to have. And when it manifests in the world, it manifests through compassionate activity. Activity that reduces the suffering of others. Sympathetic joy is the mind of a bodhisattva. And the bodhisattva is the Buddhist saint who denies their own perfection, denies their own liberation in nirvana until all others have been saved. In Tibetan Buddhism, it's a very important concept. And so in the enlightenment experience, what you're doing is you're training yourself to have equanimity and you're training yourself to have sympathetic joy. So you will be giving your pleasure up. You will be giving your happiness up. You will be giving your success up as a bodhisattva. And now you will find your pleasure, happiness, and success in the pleasure, happiness, success of others. You are going to be totally committed the rest of your life to compassionate work, service to community. Equanimity is the most important part of this whole model because you'll be asked and sent and feel obligated to go and do things that are terrible, you know, where there is so much suffering and death and destruction, like Mother Teresa, perhaps. So if you don't have equanimity, balance of mind, you might go nuts. You might go crazy and take your own life. So the Bodhisattva ideal is just an amazing concept. It's the Buddhist saint. They're preparing themselves as a vessel to be of service to others. Not because it's the right thing to do, but because there's so much suffering in the world. So, that's how you can get rid of your ill will and anger and hatred. Sloth and torpor, slacker, being lazy, listlessness, lazy stretching of the body, drowsiness after meals, mental sluggishness, sounds like me, frequently giving unwise attention to, this is what arises when sloth and torpor are there. So how do you de-nourish that? There is the element of rousing one's energy, the element of exertion, the element of continuous exertion, frequently giving wise attention to it. You know, if I'm feeling really lazy during the day, I'll take the dog for a walk. And he always likes to go for a walk. But just the activity of walking invigorates me. If I'm feeling really lazy and I'm meditating, I usually meditate with my eyes closed. I'll open my eyes. And hopefully there's a light on, or it's light, so it'll stimulate my brain. If I'm lazy, I might do a little breathing technique, to sort of fire breathing sort of thing, to get more oxygen in. Sleep is so difficult to fight when you're meditating. And it's the opponent that you can't see, you can only feel. And it's warm and cozy. And it's telling you it's okay. If you just close your eyes for a few moments, you'll feel so much better when you open them. And there you go, and you're just sort of like seduced. And then there is a transition from wakefulness to sleep where I find in my mind the discursive thought shifts as well. That there's a certain way I speak in my head when I'm awake and a certain way I speak in my head when I'm sleeping. So my dreams have a different kind of rhythm and cadence to them than my wakeful state. So I'm able to see the cadence change as I drift off, and that's a warning to me. I'm also able, if I need to get to sleep and can't sleep, I'm also able to change the cadence in my head into sleep talk instead of wakeful talk. Now, I don't know if that makes any sense at all to you, but it's interesting, and it came to me because I kept falling asleep in meditation. You know, and it was just so easy. And here I'm sitting on a hard cushion on a hard floor with no backrest, no arms. You would think it'd be the most uncomfortable position at all, and yet you can still fall asleep. It's not hard. And I guess people fall asleep when they're driving their cars, and people fall asleep all the time doing all sorts of things. So sleep is a tough one. And if you feel that you're getting sleepy, if there's a break in your meditation, say you're meditating for 3 hours and you have, you know, breaks in between, stand up, you know, do some stretches and stuff. Get the blood moving. It'll help you. Sometimes, though, no matter what you do, you're going to fall asleep. And I've seen people just lay down and sleep in the zendo. Everybody else is meditating. They're just sleeping. As long as they don't snore, it's okay. But they wake up and they're ready, and then they'll sit back up again, you know. Has anybody had that problem with sleep? Does anybody?
You mean meditation?
Sleep, yeah.
Every time we've meditated, or when I've meditated, I doze off.
And do you have any techniques to sort of stay awake? Or you just...
Well, it's probably bad. I kind of do, you know, what
okay.
Everyone does when they start to doze off, because I realize I'm doing it. But no, I don't know.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, sometimes they start to bounce around like a bobblehead toy, you know. They're trying to get their balance again. Sleep, wake, sleep, wake. Yeah. It's tough. So, open your eyes, stand up, keep the circulation going, get more sleep, you know. I know we're all sleep deprived. Some of us don't get enough sleep, you know. 5-6 hours, you know, busy days and stuff. So, maybe the best time to meditate is in the morning after you wake up. You know, when you're the most rested and most peaceful. And after a long day, meditating is like, well, you know, it's almost too difficult. So maybe walking meditation instead of sitting meditation, maybe mantra recitation instead of quiet meditation. And then it gives you something to do, and it keeps the air circulating because you're chanting. And next week we're going to chant the Heart Sutra. So we'll see what that's like, and I'll bring you all a copy, and I'll explain it to you, and then we'll do it the way we do it at our center. And it's a lot of fun. And okay. How about the opposite now? Restlessness and regret. There is unrest in the mind, frequently giving unwise attention to it. How can we de-nourish restlessness and remorse? Six things are conducive to the abandonment of restlessness. One, knowledge of the Buddhist scriptures, doctrine and discipline, asking questions about them, familiarity with the Vinaya, the code of the monastic discipline, and for lay followers with the principles of moral conduct. What I find as I read Buddhism and read the doctrine of Buddhism or the sutras of Buddhism, I find that I feel better about myself. And it's really odd. If I'm having a tough day and I read a couple sutras or a story or two dealing with Buddhism, I just feel better. It's like it's okay to be unskillful, because all human beings are unskillful, but at the heart of our unskillfulness is our perfection. So we're already perfect. And sure, I shouldn't have said that when I was playing my harmonica about sucking and blowing, you know? It was a little too much. But then I'm thinking, well, you know, I was foolish and excited about the reaction to my presentation, and I'm not a Buddha yet, you know? And so for me, if I'm getting down on myself and I start reading the Buddha sutras, I feel better. It's about how to be a human being. And it's not about being evil, it's about being unskillful. And that makes me feel much more comfortable about things. Noble friendship and suitable conversation. Again, they're coming back to friendship and conversation. Now we have skeptical doubt. This is a tough thing. Skeptical doubt will get you off the cushion. And, you know, why am I doing it? What purpose is there? Will it lead to anything good? Am I just wasting my time? Who is the Buddha anyway? He probably never existed. This is all just a legend. And then you get up and go watch Seinfeld, you know, and your cushion is just sitting there waiting for you to return. So we really need to understand why we're meditating. And sometimes we need to remind ourselves why we are meditating. And if you're a Buddhist and doing Buddhist meditation in particular, you need to understand how meditation fits into Buddhism. What's the practicality of it? What does it lead us to? Why is it important? Why is it even necessary? And it is necessary. And what I have found, and again, they say the stream enter, the very first level of nirvana, you lose all skeptical doubt. What I have found is that what replaces your skeptical doubt is confidence. And confidence is such a wonderful tool. Much better than faith, for me. That people say have faith. Buddhism says, no, test it to be true, and you will have confidence. And that confidence will override your skeptical doubt. So, if you're wondering why you're meditating, you really need to investigate that. Why do I want to meditate? What in me is sort of driving me in that direction? Is it the wholesome part of me or the unwholesome part of me? The skillful part or the unskillful part? And why is there such resistance sometimes? And we were talking earlier, and that's... We, in Buddhism, think of it as being Mara. Mara is the great tempter. Mara is also death, described as death. But in this case, it's the great tempter. So we don't have this ultimately evil, always bad Satan guy. You know, the Satan guy is never, ever going to be good. Mara is not like that. Mara is not ultimately evil. Mara is not a bad guy. Mara is like he's a rascal. And he always wants to test you and see how you're doing. You know, so I'm in the grocery store minding my own business, buying some cat food, and I walk by the bakery aisle, and there are the donuts. And, you know, Mara's talking to me. Hey, they're on sale, Kusla. You get 12 for $3.99. Well, you know, it's me and my cat. I don't think he's going to have any donuts. Do I need 12 donuts? Hey, they're on sale. You save a lot of money getting 12. And that's Mara talking to me. And I'm going, whoa. You know, Mara's always with me. He rides right here on my shoulder and whispers in my ear. Other people can't hear him, but I hear him well. So this is where the skeptical doubt comes from. You know, this is that thing, well, I don't know. And do we need to commit ourselves to a meditation practice? We really do. It's not going to work if you don't have a commitment. Because there are so many times when you're not going to want to meditate. When it's just so easy to say, no, I'll do it tomorrow and tomorrow. And that tomorrow never seems to come. Is there anything wrong with taking time off from meditation? No. But you need to give yourself permission. You need to say, okay, for the next 2 weeks, I'm not going to meditate. I got other stuff to do. I want to absorb and I want to classify all this new information that's coming to me because of my meditation practice. And so I'm just going to take a couple weeks off. But don't take a couple weeks off because you don't want to meditate. Don't take a couple weeks off because you got so many things to do. You got to give yourself permission to do it. You know? And again, I'm sort of a control person because I have Vista. And so I think we need to be accountable for our meditation practice. This practice is our vehicle to enlightenment. Man, that is the best gift anybody could ever have. That all you got to do is do it and everything else happens by itself. You don't have to worry about it. You don't have to be concerned about it. Your job is to get to the cushion every day. And enlightenment will occur. It already has occurred. We just don't realize it yet. And great, okay. So that's the kind of mental attitude you need when skeptical doubt arises. And you say, what's the point? I'll do it when I'm old. I'm young now. I want to have fun. Well, you know, the problem with putting off meditation is sometimes you get too old to meditate. You can't sit on the floor. You've got ADD now because you've watched too many commercials. You know, and you just go, wow. You know, and we have one guy at the center. He's not that old. He's like in his 60s. Bladder problem. In the bathroom 12 times during Sunday service. You know? So here you are. You want to meditate. You've decided now is the time. You can't even sit down and meditate. So while you're healthy and got a body and a mind that's working properly, that's the time to invest in your meditation practice. I know it sounds odd. No, but it'll make you die better.
You mean die healthier, or what do you mean by
die better?
Yeah.
Okay. Meditation is at some level the practice of dying into the present moment. And so what we're doing is we're taking 20 minutes and we're practicing letting go of everything for 20 minutes. We're dying into the present moment. And when we finally have to say goodbye to everyone, we'll be letting go of everything forever. But we've had these little 20-minute periods during the day for weeks, months, years now. And we start to see that, yeah, there's a technique to letting go. There's a technique to dying into the present moment. We have watched our consciousness drift apart in deep states of meditation and come together again. And we don't fear that any longer. It all makes sense. So, this is not a real big selling point if you're 20 years old that you'll die better, but if you are practicing for 20 years, that's a nice thing to know. That when you go to that hospital or that hospice and it's your time to check out, you've got something to do. You're not a victim.
Aren't you coming back anyway, though?
You are. You are.
You're
kind of
temporary.
You are. It's just a temporary release from the suffering of life. You're absolutely right.
Doesn't the state of mind, though, that you're at when you die also determine the
state of mind when you're born, the next lifetime?
Right.
Yeah. So you don't want hatred and anger. You don't want sloth and torpor. You don't want agitation and worry. You don't want sensual desire. Those things will give you a strange rebirth. You're absolutely right. Yeah, so we need to be clear. And when I spoke at that chaplain's conference, the hospital chaplains, they were asking about medication. Is there anything wrong with medication if you're a Buddhist and in the hospital? Yeah, I said there's something wrong with too much medication because then we lose clarity and can't practice. See, This is an odd thing, perhaps, because this practice that you may start, that I have started, is our salvation. It's our refuge, and we need to continue practicing in every feasible situation we're going to find ourselves in. Now, that doesn't mean sitting on the ground on a cushion. That means practicing mindfulness if you're in an argument, watching anger rise and hopefully pass away. You know, watching the delusion in the grocery store as the donuts are on sale and watching that arise and go, whoa. Yeah, all those kind of things. That's our practice now. Our life has become our practice. And when we find ourselves in the hospital, that's when this practice pays off. That's the time. And one of the guys that was coming to our center, his name was George, had cancer, and he was dying. And he was dying at the Veterans Hospital on Wilshire Boulevard. And so they called me up. I forget what the term is they use, but it isn't a hospice, but it's when there's no cure and they can't save you, but their job is to make you comfortable, palliative care.
That's hospice.
It's a modified hospice, yeah. And it's great. His job, and he had this cancer that just took over his face, and he was just tough to look at. So the nurse said, can we get a picture of George before he was sick so the nurses can relate to him as a human being and not as this, you know. And so George is there, and we're talking. They called me up. George said, well, Kusala's, you know, the guy I meditate with, you know, call him up. So we started to talk, and we turned off the TV, first thing, get rid of the TV. We had some Buddhist chanting that was recorded. We found a cassette recorder, a CD recorder, and a player, so we could play this CD. And I would come and talk to him, what I would tell him is the stuff we had talked about in our meditation classes, you know, the techniques, going one-pointedness. This is going to sound weird, but when you see the light, the internal sort of light, that's the direction you want to go. If you see darkness, you go away from the darkness and that kind of stuff. And so I gave him instructions and I gave him stuff to do while he's in the hospital. And then I saw him the day before he died and he couldn't talk anymore. But he was able to nod. He was able to move, yes or no. And so I was asking him some stuff and the whole time, I was giving him stuff to do so he wouldn't be a victim of his disease. I was giving him stuff to do so he would be in charge. And he was taking a proactive stance on this. He said, okay, I'm going to die well because I need to get reborn. Now, if you're not a Buddhist, that may sound really weird, you know, because if you're a Christian, Catholic in particular, maybe the last rites, you know, hey, you know, or somebody pray for you. And we have that in Buddhism too. But basically, me and George were doing our meditation practice there. And George was meditating. And they didn't over-medicate him. He had some clarity. Towards the end, you know, it was hard to communicate with him because everything was sort of like changing. But he was still able to nod in agreement that the practice was working. And then he died. You know, and then I cried. It's really weird. It's so, because you know he's going to die. I mean, it's just a matter of time. But to let somebody go, and you just sort of cry, and you go, yeah, life sucks. Death does too. And then you go have a cup of coffee and go through the rest of your day. That's sort of what happens, I guess, you know. So birth and death are both really difficult situations for humans to be in. And I don't remember how difficult it was for me to be born, but I'm sure my mom does. Mm-hmm. And I probably will be very aware of how difficult it's going to be to die, you know. And so we'll see. If the doctors can take care of the pain, Buddhism can take care of the suffering. And that's why meditators who practice Buddhism, I think, have a better chance of dying well than someone who doesn't have a religious tradition or is going to rely on someone else to make their transition easier for them. Any comments on that?
So you say Buddhists pray for other people. So
yeah.
What are you praying for? Less suffering?
Yeah, less suffering, more kindness, more clarity.
For that person themselves.
Yes, and for us, and for ourselves. Compassion and wisdom. Those are the two wings of the bird in Buddhism. And so we're wishing and sharing our merit. Anything we do that allows us to acquire merit, we give back. So others can use that merit to acquire wisdom and compassion. I call it clarity and kindness. And the world would be a much better place if we could share our clarity and kindness with everyone.
But unlike Christianity, you're not praying to something. You're just saying, I really hope that this person doesn't suffer, right?
That's exactly right. We're not seeking divine intervention. But as we were talking about earlier, if you're having an argument with somebody and you forgive them, they can sense that you've forgiven them and the relationship shifts. I think people can sense when we're wishing them good thoughts, you know, and good luck and good karma and good speech and good action. I think our intention manifests in some nonverbal way in the world and benefits everyone. So you're right, we're not praying to a god or a divine being. What we're doing is we're uploading that information in our own consciousness to change our consciousness and the way we respond to the world around us. Now that's early Buddhism. That's maybe a little different. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, no, I like that thing that you said after listening to your first lecture and about keeping your hands just open, because I think like in the Catholic religion or in some of the other religions, you know, you're praying and you're, but there's almost always a sense of, you know, I want this to happen. I mean, it's got to happen. I'm doing the praying, so it better happen. This God better, you know, come through. And so there's a feeling of, you know, grasping and holding on to even what you're doing to, you know.
Well, it seems like you're also letting go of control. It's not, you're letting someone else control the situation,
yeah.
God, instead of, from what I hear you say, it's all about what we do as ourselves,
yeah.
Together.
Yeah, and this is an early Buddhist perspective that it is all about us. The Buddha said our entire universe exists in this fathom-long body. So it's been said before in many different ways, but we create our world, you know. Now, if I can create my world in a way that affects your world in a positive way, then what I'm doing is skillful. It's sort of that kind of thing. We're not seeking relationship in the same way I think that Christians seek relationship with God or Jesus. And that in that relationship is found love and comfort and you'll be taken care of because you believe. It's a much more, I don't want to say lonely, but there's a level of aloneness in Buddhism that seems to not be as identifiable in other religions. That in a lot of cases, we're not meditating with other people, we're meditating alone. You know, if we're lucky enough to have a sangha, a group of people who meditate, we might be able to read sutras together and discuss those. Or if you have a teacher, you go to a teaching and the teacher comes in, you have 1,000 people and that kind of stuff. But basically, my understanding is this, that when we came into the world, we came in alone, and when we leave the world, we're going to leave alone, and the best refuge is our practice. And so, no matter what good intentions other people might have for us, they really can't do much for us. You know, and I'm single, so take that in consideration, that if you are in a committed, loving relationship with another human being, that's your partner, you know, and you can sort of help each other out through tough times and experience good times together. And that's great. That's a wonderful gift you've been given to find someone to journey through life with. But no matter how good that person is and no matter how much you love them, sooner or later they will die or you will die. And there you are again, all alone. Now, I don't want to paint a bleak picture, but what I'm saying is that my understanding of Buddhism says we really need to sort of be ready, you know, to work on ourselves in any situation. And if people are around us or helping us with our practice, encouraging us, like I was with George, encouraging George, I wasn't his refuge. You know, his practice was his refuge. The Dharma was his refuge. I was just reminding him what he needed to do. So it's sort of that kind of thing. Yes, please.
So when people look to you, because they will and they do, as a refuge, what do you do to kind of help them to see that it's not you?
Oh, yeah. Well, I say really stupid things, and you know, I look as unenlightened as possible, and it actually works pretty good. You know? Sometimes with the podcast and the stuff, the people get weird, you know, ideas about who I am, and I really just need to say, hey, you know, it's not about me at all; it's about you. All I'm trying to do is tell you what I did, and maybe that'll be helpful to you. And so there needs to be that reality check. And I see people who see celebrities. They just, you know, and you just go, wow. And celebrities sometimes like that, but then there are sometimes when celebrities say, hey, wake up, you know. That's just what I do for a living, or, you know. Yeah, I'm just a genetic celebrity. I just look good in this lifetime because of genes and chromosomes and some good karma, you know, whatever. And so, yeah, I really have to be cautious. That it's not that I don't get as misinterpreted as I could in what I do and how I do it. So I'm alert to that. And what I tell people when they say, "Can you be my teacher?" I say, "No, I don't have students." And they go, "Well, that's really weird." I said, "Well, I'm better at speaking to groups because I have a big persona. I'm big, and I can fill a room. Big in a sense physically as well as psychically. And if I'm working one-on-one, I'm just too big for that. I'm just not too big in the sense of being successful or enlightened, but just being too big in the sense of not being able to be small. I don't know how to be small. So, and my dad was the same way too. He was for a long time, when he was younger, he was a comedian and entertainer on stage. And you would sit in a room with him and be about this size, and he would, like, yell. He just, blah, 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 and his arms would be going, and he was just so big and just so obnoxious. Dad, talk quiet, you know. And so I don't take students. I say, if somebody wants to study with me, they can do it through my podcasts, through my website, you know, through giving personal talks or giving talks to groups. And that is the way I stay away from that stuff, you know?
I had a yoga teacher once when I asked him, "Are you a teacher?" Because I was new to the class. He said, "No, you're the teacher." And that really freaked me out. But it's kind of like what
yeah.
saying.
Yeah.
It's up to me to...
To do the poses.
To do it, yeah.
He's just showing you how he does it. Yeah. And I think people want us to, you know, to be them and to do it for them. And you can't, you know. Maybe that's why other religions are so popular, because there's this sense that all I have to do is, you know, submit myself, you know, and then I will be taken care of. And it sounds really comforting to be taken care of, but geez, you know. When you get to that point, I don't know. Then you get abused, you know? It seems. The cults, you know, the cults will take care of you, and then they do take care of you, but not in a very good way. Yes?
So the concept of Buddhism is the whole purpose is to relieve suffering. As we come into the world, we suffer. I'm just wondering if there's any search for the Buddhist path. Because, you know, as you're talking about, like, you know, birth and stuff, like, painful. For me, I have 33-hour labor and now delivery, like, the worst you possibly could be as far as, like, the kind of delivery I had. But the minute he came out, there was, like, such amazing joy and happiness and
yes.
bliss.
Yes.
You know? So, like, I'm just not hearing
no.
that.
You'll never hear that from me. But it's not that it's not there. Buddhism is about the end of suffering. It's not necessarily about why we suffer, but that's what you have to get through first. You have to explain to everybody why they're suffering. And I'm fond of saying, I didn't suffer until I became a Buddhist. And then I really suffered. So now it's about the end of suffering. And you say, well, how about the joy? How about the happiness? I don't ever talk about joy and happiness. And that's because we're over 20. And there's no reason to. What I'm talking about is Buddhism is a path of renunciation. And the reason you don't have joy is not because it's not there. I think it's inherent in you. It's inherent in all of us. We have joy and happiness. But there's sadness and there's pain. There's delusion. There's anger. There's greed. There's lust. It blocks our perfect joy and happiness. So my job is not to say, hey, you need more joy in your life. My job is to say, hey, what's preventing that joy in your life from becoming a realization? Why doesn't it appear? It's not because it's not there. So in a way, it's a really positive message. It means you're perfect. And that joy appeared not miraculously, but of course it appeared because that was always with you. And that newborn didn't give it to you. That was your joy. He didn't give you anything. Nothing migrated from him to you. What he was a catalyst. And he pushed a button in you, and your joy manifested profoundly. And you said, oh, I love him because he made me joyful. Well, he didn't do anything. You did it. And so when people are sort of like working on their happiness and stuff, it's not that they're not already happy, it's just there's a couple clouds blocking their happiness, so we need to get rid of that. So I keep harping on what we got to get rid of, what we need to get rid of, because this is an ascetic path. This is a path where no accumulation occurs. And it's so different from most other religions, where people are giving you stuff all the time, giving you love. I love you, my son. I love you, my son. Well, okay, but you loving me doesn't give me love, you know? And it took me a long time to realize that in my own life when I was, you know, dating and had girlfriends and stuff, and I would fall in love, and I would assume that they were giving me the chance to be in love, and they were doing something to me. They were giving me love. Oh, I love you. Oh, thanks, I'll accept that. It feels so good to be loved. And then I started to see that love that I attributed to them was really my love. That I wasn't getting anything from them at all, other than being able to find the love that was already inside of me. And I went, wow, if that love's always inside of me, then why can't it happen more often without having to date and go out to dinner and go on vacations? Why can't I be in love every moment of every day? You know? And as it turns out, when you see these people that have found their own love, they're happy and blissful and light, and they don't need anybody or anything in their life to make them happy. They have found their happiness. I thought, man, that is so cool. They're not dependent on anything. And yet, their happiness affects everyone around them. And in a way, it's sort of showing people that, yeah, you've got it already. It's already there. Stop looking outside for your happiness. Start looking inside for your happiness. And I think most religious paths say the same thing. It's all about the inside. It's all there. So do we need partners? I think humans do need partners. I think humans function best when they have other people in their life. I do not have a specific partner. I have 30 residents. Hey, who's feeling sorry for me? I get to love and hate every day. It's all there. You know? And I look at people who've been married for 20 or 30 years. Sometimes they turn into brothers and sisters. And they start to look like each other. And I'm so glad they found each other. That is so cool. But they became like the best friends. And they did their journey together. You know, they weren't one, I don't think, in their journey, but they did their journey together. They were connected in a very special way. They had trust with each other. They had confidence in each other. Maybe they had faith in each other. And it was never proven wrong. You know? And so, do I miss that? One of the girls, the same girl that said the thing about the STDs, you know, are monks celibate because they're afraid of getting STDs? Well, no. Then she said, can I ask you a personal question? Does it sort of bother you that you're not going to have children and somebody to love you in this lifetime? That you're not going to get married? She was really concerned for me. She was probably 16 or 17. And I said, well, you know, as a Buddhist, I believe that I've had many lifetimes of being married. And I have been wives, and I have been husbands, and I have been grandfathers and grandmothers. I've been aunts and uncles. And in this lifetime, I just thought I'd do it a little differently. You know? And she, I don't know if she got it. But if this is your only life, I would say, yeah, you know, maybe you're missing out on something. But if you're like a Hindu or a Buddhist, you sort of realize that you've been everybody's relative and friend for a very long time. You just have these different roles you keep playing each time you're reborn. And so this role, for whatever reason, was the role of being in community, being in love, but not being in love with a special one, trying to be in love with everyone, which it can be really difficult, you know?
If you're happy, it affects other people.
Yes.
But on the other hand, you're saying, I can't be happy unless I'm happy myself. Other people aren't affected. So how does that work?
Well, it works as you meditate and as you see loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Eventually what you're doing is you are being happy because others are happy around you. It's that you're responding to their happiness and their success. You see? At first, we realize that we have this happiness inside of us. But if we're going to take the Bodhisattva path and be of service to all, then we have to give up our happiness in a very interesting way. We have to instead trade our happiness for equanimity, perfect balance, so we can experience the happiness of others in a pure way and in a connected way, and also experience the suffering of others as our suffering and respond to that in a skillful way too. And this was the stumbling block for me in the whole model of enlightenment, that I couldn't figure out why we had to get rid of our own happiness and our own pleasure. And it was to make room for the happiness and pleasure of others that we'd be experiencing through the practice of equanimity, not getting attached to it, not being repulsed by it. And so if you're happy because your partner's happy, I suppose there's no difference in the happiness, whether it's yours or theirs. It's the same reaction. And I have seen people that have been together for a really long time, they're happy because their partner's happy. And that is so cool. And it's the same kind of happiness. So, as a monastic, as a meditator, as a single guy, I see that there's a happiness inside of me. That's my happiness. I see if I can transcend my own happiness, I can also experience the happiness of others. You know? But I don't have to be happy because others are happy. I have the ability to be happy because I've always had that happiness inside of me. And I don't know if that makes sense, because when I hear myself say that, it sounds like a puzzle, you know? But when I see it happening around me, when I see people who are happy because others are happy, I see people who practice generosity not because it makes them feel good, but because in a very real way, the person they're giving to is themselves. They've come to the conclusion that all things are interconnected and interdependent. And they're not really giving the money away at all. They still have it. But they've given it to this person who's totally connected to who they are. And we're like, whoa, that is such a trip. So sometimes people give money, practice generosity, helping others. Sometimes people practice generosity because they want to get rid of their greed. So, and that's how I started. I never gave money to help other people. I gave money because I had too much greed. And the more I gave, the less greed I had. So it wasn't about the other person at all. And people say, that is so selfish, Kusala. Man. But then, you know, ultimately it's the same thing. Whether you're doing it for them, it still helps you. If you do it for you, it helps that, you know. So it just depends where you need to start. I needed to start with me and then work out from there. So my happiness, I need to start with my happiness and then work out from there. Love is a tough one because if you're in love with someone, it means you're always kind to them. Can you love everybody? Can you be kind to everybody? Cool, man. And so, sometimes if you have lust, you can be kind to them because lust and love are so close, they can get confusing. But pure love. And so I see the challenges of this path. This path leads to a broken heart, you know? This path is designed to break your heart. And once your heart's broken, your compassion arises in the world. And it may seem like a subtle form of sadness, but what you're really doing is you're really connecting to people in all their many ways and feeling their feelings and sensing their fears and saying, yeah, every human being has those fears. And isn't it difficult to work with? And so people can get connected to you in strange ways. They think, oh, this person loves me. Yeah. And then they say, well, let's have sex. No. And you go, why not? Because that's not love. That's lust. Lust is good. That's why we're all here. But this path is really about love. This path is really about open heart and kindness being expressed at every moment. And I fail miserably on a daily basis, but I realize that's why I'm practicing, because I'm not there yet. And I get more time to practice than you do, because I don't have a full-time job. So, and I often thought that maybe one of the reasons I decided to become ordained was because I needed more time to work on myself. So you guys are probably all better than I am at doing this. That's why you're not ordained. Did that answer your question in a roundabout way, or would you like to?
Yeah, I don't think I like holding on to that happiness and joy. I like to be at a place of equanimity. And I don't know. I'm thinking, I really like sensation. I really like happiness. I really like joy.
Okay. And what are they always connected to?
What are they always connected to? Feeling good.
What is feeling good always connected to? Feeling bad. You can't have one without the other. And that's the dilemma that we as Buddhists face. It's great to feel good, but it's not so great to feel bad. And so if I give up feeling bad, I sort of have to give up feeling good too. And that requires me to have balance. And most people enjoy the roller coaster ride. Good, bad, good, bad. It makes them feel alive. They feel invigorated. They're stimulated. And yeah, I agree, but maybe at some point in your life, maybe in 20 years from now, you'll say, this roller coaster is just making me tired. I don't want to go high and low anymore. I want to go more to the middle. I just want to have peace. And would you exchange your joy for peace? And I would say probably not. Not yet. And that's understandable. Most people don't see peace as having as much value as happiness and pleasure and joy. But just maybe one day, you know, we'll find ourselves on Walden's Pond, looking out at the little lake and going, yeah, this is peaceful. This feels good. I've come home. All that flash in the trash that I was attracted to, tried to make it me and mine, you know. That was okay when I was younger, but now I just want to have peace. And then we take our last breath, and it's taken in peace. And we're not fighting and saying it's not time yet, and why me, and it's not fair. And And so in a way, we're preparing ourselves to end, but in doing that, we're preparing ourselves to live fully in each moment and not have to be attached to the good stuff, not to have to want the good stuff to happen, but let it happen naturally, experience it completely, and then let it go. That's it. And so many people want their joy and happiness to be the way they want it to be. And it's amazing how many places we can find joy and happiness. You know, a flower blooming, the old cliches, they're all true. It's all right there, too. You know, it's just we're urbanites, you know. We're in this, like, place where it's big happiness and big joy. We got Staples Center, Nokia Theater, and I'm going, wow, yeah. But that big stuff is really tiring sometimes. And so when I sit in the backyard, and I'm not that old yet, but when I sit in the backyard, I got the dog and I got the koi pond and the finches are chirping over there and some of the sparrows are coming in now. Spring is in bloom and it's just, oh, the orange blossoms. We have an orange tree back. Can you smell that? Those moments bring great joy to me and happiness. And it's so subtle. And I have to be so quiet to really appreciate it. I can't be thinking about profound things or giving presentations. I just have to be peaceful. And there it is. This world is such a beautiful place. And until I became peaceful, I missed the beauty. It's amazing, the colors and the smells and how things feel. You know, a freshly mowed lawn. And I know we've killed all that grass, but it sure smells good. And it's just we didn't kill it, we just sort of wounded it for a while. But yeah, so it's sort of that kind of thing. It's sort of coming to that place, that peaceful center that we have. And it's just like the cyclone, I suppose, isn't it? Or the tornado, when they have the peaceful center. So that's how I see it. Now, you've got kids, so you can't be too peaceful. Because you've got to stay up with them.
Going to the library, and like every 2 seconds he would stop to pick up dirt and hand me the dirt, flowers. But like, I mean, there's like a sense of like so much joy watching him, you know. I mean, he's just like examining everything, and so it's like, I don't know, the idea of kind of, I don't know, I feel like just being in the state of equanimity that I'm like would be missing that excitement that he has, like, for the, you know, he's picking up the flowers.
Yeah, you know, I think maybe what we have is we have, you know, what the enemy of equanimity is? Indifference. Mm-hmm. And it's not about indifference.
Okay.
You know, it's simply about not committing yourself one way or the other. Mm-hmm. Not committing yourself to joy or sorrow. When she's watching her son with the dirt?
He's so joyful, and she's just...
Yes. Yes. It, well, it is.
Joy out of his joy.
And what is he finding joy in? He's finding joy in dirt. Who would have thought? And we used to find joy in dirt, too, because that used to be us. It's the evolution of humankind. You get to watch the evolution of humankind right in your own house. And, yeah, and the little flower, and he hands you the flower. And you see, what does he see in that? It's things that we can't anymore. And so, really, it's about simplifying our life so much that we can pick up a handful of dirt and smile and see, pardon the expression, and see God in it and go, whoa.
Some people do, but they just take a lot of drugs.
Yes, they do. And meditators meditate, you know, so yes, it's true. It's true. But it's always there. See, that's the part that I didn't realize, you know, because I was waiting to be happy because I needed to do something to make me happy, and I needed to do a happy thing. You know, so you would go out to a movie to be happy. Now, your son picks up dirt that's right there. No, people walked on it for all day and paid no attention to it at all. He found a happiness right there. He didn't have to go to a movie or a playground or whatever makes him happy or makes you think he's happy, but it's always there. And then that sympathetic joy thing. So I think being a parent allows you to see a lot of stuff that non-parents don't see. The innocence and purity of humankind before we get preferences and opinions and shoulds, we should do this, we should do that, before all that stuff starts, that's what we were. And I think that meditation allows us to transcend back to that place. You know, you can't ever go back. You can't forget everything you've learned. You can't get rid of all your opinions, but you can transcend them. And you and your son maybe one day will be able to pick up the same dirt and have the same joy. Wouldn't that be cool? So, yeah, so I don't want you to think that it's like being a robot or a vegetable or indifferent. It's simply, I think what, for me, what it means is that I don't choose to make it happen, I let it happen. You know what I'm sort of saying when I say that? And this meditation practice allows us to sort of get out of the way for a while, you know, and let that stuff happen naturally, whatever it might be. I think it was probably time. Man!
Do you have any time to meditate?
I think we do, but isn't it amazing? It's like it's talking samadhi, where all this, like in this present moment, is 2 hours go away. Isn't it a trip? Well, we've been talking about really important stuff, what it means to be a human being, you know, and most people don't get a chance to talk about this at all during the day. It's all about the other stuff that we talked about when we first started, all the idle gossip and chatter. So shall we sit and, do you want to take a quick break before we sit, or shall we just, yes, okay, let's take a quick break, and I have nothing planned other than walking the dog, so I'll leave it up to you.